This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Brian So Jones. He is the author of Raking the Hollow Bones, published by Fairweather Books, an imprint of Bedbug Press in Brownsville, Oregon, and winner of a Rhea and Seymour Gorse Line poetry competition. Jones spells his name Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, So, T-S-O, Jones. Brian, would you talk for a moment about the personal meaning of this particular collection of poems to you, and then maybe talk about the structure of the book, which includes a prelude, five sections, and a coda, along with some helpful notes to the poems?
I think the main reason why is because I've always been interested in different cultures. My own background being Chinese American, my father was American and my mom is Chinese. So I've always found it kind of interesting to look at the different aspects between two different cultures and growing up in two different cultures, both in terms of just my own personal life and then in terms of other aspects like language. I'm not fluent in Chinese, but I know how to speak it to a certain degree. And kind of correlating with that too, I have a large interest in kind of the stories and that I've heard from like both sides of my family, mythological stories and folk tales, and how those in turn either have some commonalities or differences too as well. Yeah, the structure, it's basically the book more or less is split into five sections with a prelude poem and a concluding poem. And each of the five sections, basically, each section takes a particular theme from Confucius, actually, or Kongzi is his name. Some of the topics that he talks about in like some of his works, the Analects, and so on. Like the first section, for example, is titled Family. The second section, I think, is Spirits or Ghosts. And what I wanted to do mainly was to take some of the ideas that that Confucius presents in his philosophies and use those as kind of a touchstone to organize some of the poems around. And then either those poems speak to or sometimes against what actually what the section is kind of about. So there's in each section, if you look, there's a quotation that I take from the Analects, I think. And then depending on how you choose to read the poems, then you can have a conversation or a dialogue with that.
Why don't you go ahead and read the opening poem of the book, Zhang Xian and the Boy with the Gold Key.
Zhang Xian and the Boy with the Gold Key. Threatened by a question from the Song Emperor, my name was born from a court lady's lips. In this incarnation, I am the speaker, Zhang Xian, protector of children, warden of dreams. I am a male Guanyin, Sichuan bamboo layered with elm. My bow draws taut as I wander gardens of ivory and horn, where goddesses, gods, ghosts, and poets rail in the waking hours. Listen, animals of the 12 houses, this boy has carried me back inside him. He bears a gold key we have misplaced. It opens the door we shut in our youth. Gather the threads left by ghost whispers into this silk embroidery. For what are they but the colors of our myths? The needle we press to bone.
Would you explain who Zhang Xian is?
Like the male protector of children and a warden of warden of dreams, kind of the equivalent of the Sandman or Morpheus. Originally, they basically say that he originated mainly in Sichuan area originally and was supposed to be a replacement for Guanyin at one point, but the attempt was not very successful because they were trying to get rid of basically all foreign goddesses, basically. And she came from India originally. And so they had a kind of had this male god that tried to supplant her, but the his popularity never really grew, and so he kind of fell out of popularity and has been forgotten, more or less. So
that poem was influenced by The Gold Key, a poem written by Anne Sexton. I'll read her poem first, and then maybe you'd like to comment on that. The Gold Key. The speaker in this case is a middle-aged witch, me, tangled on my two great arms, my face in a book, and my mouth wide, ready to tell you a story or two. I have come to remind you, all of you, Alice, Samuel, Kurt, Eleanor, Jane, Brian, Marielle, all of you draw near. Alice, at 56, do you remember? Do you remember when you were read to as a child? Samuel, at 22, have you forgotten? Forgotten the 10 p.m. dreams where the wicked king went up in smoke? Are you comatose? Are you undersea? Attention, my dears, let me present to you this boy. He is 16 and he wants some answers. He is each of us. I mean you. I mean me. It is not enough to read Hess and drink clam chowder. We must have the answers. The boy has found a gold key. And he is looking for what it will open. This boy, upon finding a nickel, he would look for a wallet. This boy, upon finding a string, he would look for a harp. Therefore, he holds the key tightly. Its secrets whimper like a dog in heat. He turns the key. Presto! It opens this book of odd tales which transform the Brothers Grimm. Transform? As if an enlarged paper clip could be a piece of sculpture. And it could.
That poem, I came to that, read a version of that poem early on when I started writing poetry, and for some reason that one image about the there's a boy who carries a particular, you know, this gold key that like shines very brightly. It was a very powerful image that kind of stayed with me for a really long time. And so I worked kind of a little bit with that image through a few of the poems in this book, primarily, but it's kind of a source of inspiration for me.
Well, let's move on to the section called Zha, family. And maybe you can read the poem Stone Chop and explain what a stone chop is. Are they still widely used?
I think in a legal sense, they still are. Very often, actually, the most common place you'll probably see it is if a person writes a poem in Chinese calligraphy or does a painting, you'll see near their signature, there will be a chop, which is just either square or circular shaped, and it has the Chinese characters for their name. And what it was originally used is, it's kind of like when we take a legal document and go to a notary and have the notary, you know, stamp on there after you go ahead and make a signature on it to kind of show that it's an official document and it was witnessed by someone. The stone chop was the same equivalent, but was used, you know, for a very long time as this is the signature of this person. And so it's actually given more importance than your actual signature is. So very often it was dangerous sometimes if your family's chop or if, you know, an official's chop was stolen by somebody else, because then it was very easy to go ahead and forge documents and say, well, you know, this person actually wrote this. Look, you know, there's her official chop that they used. So stone chop. Ground of marbled veins, the chop's base waits for the second name Popo gave me. Grandmother whose hair twisted in bramble. After years of not seeing me, she declared I should have a new name to bear witness to ancestral ghosts who dwell across the sea. The tiger the carver chips arches its neck, muscle and fur like a ridge. Through moments, I am born again under his hands. From stone, bamboo grove flecks thick. A waterfall gushes off snow-capped peaks into mist. Hunched, the tiger crowns the weight of these mountains. When the carver pauses to rub the stiffness from his fingers, the glasses perched on his nose look wise in the burden of names.
In this same section, you have a poem called Taylor Street, 1906. Do you have ancestors who were in San Francisco during the Great Earthquake?
Yes, actually, this poem has a small epigraph that's dedicated to my great-grandmother on my dad's side of the family, who, when she was growing up, she was one of three daughters, and they actually lived in a house on Taylor Street. Taylor Street, 1906, for Gladys Pennell Luckle. 1. The flames looked as if painted on shadowbox glass. Across the street, a man slouched, a circus bear with his nightshirt half tucked like a broken wing. He sobbed, "San Francisco is all gone." I recognized the strong jaw. The great Caruso shook his head. The whine and applause of the opera house still thundered in his ears. As I listened, the sole audience of his Adorato, my dress trembled like a willow. 2. The Chinese flocked like ghosts, their faces blackened with soot. One was our cook, another pressed my dresses. "Missy, we go upstairs in barn and see many chairs with wheels. Please, Missy, may we have? If we have, we can save many of our sick and old." Each face said that past the stable, out the back gate with its broad arms, we always left open to Mason Street. Chinatown was burning. You must understand, I was frightened. But how could I not help nodding without a word? 3. Our cook, Du, ran to our boat at the dock. His arms cradled a sack like a newborn. The engine scurried. Little fire ants around the houses licked red, devouring water until the wells ran dry. The tugs in the bay had to pump raw seawater through their bowels. As the carriage rushed to the Presidio, I thought we had lost everything. But at the dock, our cook handed a bunched shawl of white silk, cowl woven with peonies and bats. Inside, the family silver rescued from the burning house, piled like stacked cards about to topple. Like so many, we never saw him again.
In the next section of the book, Guishen, or Ghosts, there's a real leap to other cultures. There's a poem, Vladimir Horowitz's Ghost Explains How Chopin's Music Works. That is a real leap away from the poems that precede it, as do the poems that follow this one.
I think in this section, it's kind of interesting because what it sort of represents is an attempt to illustrate the wide range of different kinds of ghosts and spirits in the other world, so to speak. Because if I could refer back to the opening poem, you know, there's a mention of there's gods and goddesses, and then also a lot of other figures that kind of show up. So this section kind of is a combination of all of a little bit of what that world might actually be like. So in this poem, we have, dragons and tigers and kind of magical realism going on. And then the next poem is actually based off of a historical figure, a famous pianist. Vladimir Horowitz's Ghost Explains How Chopin's Music Works. The audience's ears hover over the keys, with the bony hands of the vulture perched before them in his seat. One by one, the notes rattle, each body like a saber in its scabbard. Beating hearts are cut open as Chopin reaches in to caress laughter's face in a rubato of tears. Even the quiet moments disembowel, coda for each story left unsaid. Long afterward, even the tempo of rain hammers in its falling from the storm.
Well, I hate to leave this section already, but we have a couple of more, a few more to get through. Section 3, Ye, Righteousness, Letter to a Young Man After a Party. Would you read that poem? And then maybe you can go ahead and read The Loneliness of Li Po after that.
Letter to a Young Man After a Party. It wasn't your comment about how black hair, almond eyes, meant I came from India. That another poet's love of bass fishing prompted the question if he liked his women small-mouthed. Insincerity coiled in your apologetic hand while the other clutched the cup of beer. As you repeated, I'm sorry, I thought, this is how it begins. Caesar's belief the Druids needed Roman civilization. How a Jew was fingered by the shape of their head. My grandmother's Han ancestors built a giant wall to keep out my grandfather's horseback ancestors who got drunk off fermented mare's milk. Blood mixes where oil and wine cannot, in farmer daughters and bandit king sons who planted love bones in the earth, in our bodies too, when we met as two strangers. This morning, I sweep grass clippings from my lawn. When one drinks spirits, truths can ferment, even turn sour. The wind makes this hard. Okay, this poem has a opening line from a very famous poem by Li Po, where he's writing about loneliness because he had been exiled for a period of time from his homeland. And there's a line quoted from the Chinese that roughly translates in English, head bent, I ease down, thinking of home. And that'll be towards the end of this poem. The Loneliness of Li Po. On the ground before my bed is spread the bright moonlight. His butterfly strokes recalled dragonflies, how their wings lilted, Erfu vibrating their two strings. The banished immortal, he had wandered from the scent of jasmine like a bent grandfather who had lost his entire family. Each step a notch in the wild sword stroke that swung from carousing at the folk operas to the homesick bed that would become his poem. Snowflakes fell, nestled into one another. Bathed in the moon's ghost blades, he lifted his brush, too heavy to paint the moon. Di to si gu xiang. Brush strokes fell to paper, beaded ink from the stars. A shadow, loneliness, bent over to witness.
Thank you so much. I failed to mention that The Loneliness of Li Po appears in the fourth section of your book, Culture, or Wen, W-E-N. Let's race on now to the fifth section of the book, Ren, R-E-N, Humanity. And maybe you'd read The Gold Key and some others if we have time.
The Gold Key, well, in the middle part of the section, I do have to mention this. There's a few lines that are quoted from the poet Lizelle Mueller, her poem, Why We Tell Stories. And this poem in particular is emblematic of the gold key that we see at the beginning of the book in the opening poem. So, The Gold Key. Now the myths come full circle in their dream flight, beginning in one place, ending in another. With each stone dropped in the pond, new journeys arise. Our stories have alighted from the nest of our communal house, for the reasons the wise woman said. Because the story of our life becomes our life. Because each of us tells the same story, but tells it differently. A wistful melody no one has heard, whistled by a passing stranger in a purple scarf. When they first happen, they are a gold key discovered by the hero or heroine. When another listens, how it glistens in the light. This poem actually comes out of an experience. When I was younger, I spent a lot of time going to Chinese school, both when I lived in the Philippines and also for a few years in the States. And it was kind of interesting because my level of technical proficiency was not very good. And I think there are a lot of people who, in my house, Chinese isn't spoken regularly, even though I come from a bilingual family, simply because it would leave my father out of the conversation entirely, because he's not fluent in Chinese at all. So, this poem was kind of an attempt to illustrate what that kind of experience was like. So, Chinese school at Grace Lutheran Church. We filled the classrooms like cousin its with straight black hair. The cries of bo, po, mo, fo lumbered like a man-eating giant down the hall. Fairy Shun mothers cuckolded in a Fabergé of blouses, suit jackets, knee-length skirts. Each wanted the curse broken so their children could sing like mockingbirds. I was a giant, a seventh grader who towered in the second grade class. One day, in order to answer a question, I called my teacher Mouse instead of teacher. The inflection wrong, it perched in my mouth like an acrobat before the fatal slip. Laughter hovered like ghosts. Monkey King pressed me into my chair with hairy palms. Now, I embroider kitchen gods and dragons into silk when I write both my names, my English one and the one engraved on a stone shop housed in my box of secrets. Monkey King grins mischievous. His eyes continue to stare at my lips in order to sew them shut.
Well, Brian, so Jones, we're starting to run out of time. I'm going to ask you to stay, and I'll record more poems for a future show, a poetry party show. But right now, we'd better move to the last poem in your book, The Coda. The poem is called The Old Children.
Okay. This poem, I think it sort of talks about, mainly it talks about the descendants of people who have experienced diaspora, either because of political or social upheaval, the families end up getting broken apart or have to flee your home country and come to new place like United States or other places. And I think in a way it's kind of talking about the commonalities between groups of people who've had these kind of similar experiences and, what comes out of that, I think. The Old Children. Our fingers are chrysanthemum petals curled around cups of tea steeped in mint as if they were our hearts. We are the children of those who escaped being herded into cattle cars headed east, whose neck slipped from the red noose of Mao's banners, the ones who became crabs as they belly crawled across sand from Anatolia to desert. Gathered in a circle of grief, we compare horrors as if they were tea linens we use to wipe up a spill. Tragedy shakes her head silver at midnight. Nearby, the long dead smile crescent moons as we paint the air vibrant with our gestures.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You have been listening to Brian So Jones, B-R-Y-A-N-T-S-O Jones, reading from his collection of poetry, Raking the Hollow Bones. This was the winner of the 2007 Rhea and Seymour Gorsline Poetry Competition and was published by Fairweather Books, an imprint of Bedbug Press. Before moving on to the next segment of tonight's program, Anne Sexton, I'm going to do a little musical interlude here. This is the late Chilean singer and songwriter Ludar, who's singing a poem by James Broughton, I Saw Your Wings.
Have come to me out of the antiquities. We have loved one another for generations. We have loved one another for centuries. You teach me to trust the voice. All my voices, you teach me to believe my own believings. You touch the palpability of my possibles. Together we reflect what our mirrors conceal. Together we upgrade the sun in our meridians. Remain open night and day to transcendence. You are incompletely disguised as a mortal. You're the eternal stranger I have always known. I saw your wings this morning. Morning, I saw your wings. I saw your wings this morning. This morning, this morning, this morning, I saw your wings. Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Anne Sexton was born Anne Gray Harvey in Newton, Massachusetts on November 9, 1928. Although her childhood appeared on the surface to be one of pampering, the poems she wrote as an adult exposed something quite different: humiliation suffered at the hands of her mother, sexual abuse by her father. Sent not to college but to a finishing school for women, Sexton left that life rather quickly when, in 1948, she fell in love with Alfred Muller Sexton II, a freshman at Cornell studying to be a doctor. The heck with all that, they said, and drove in Anne's convertible to North Carolina, where it was legal to be married at 18. She left a note for her parents that read, "Oh, please forgive me and understand. I want to be married and have a family." When the Korean War broke out and Sexton's husband was sent to naval training school in Baltimore, she followed him, as she did again when he was stationed in San Francisco. She began to have violent mood shifts. When her first child was born in 1953, her anxieties were increased. She was hospitalized within a year. The death of a beloved great aunt and the birth of her second daughter sent her to the edge of whatever sanity she had. Her children were sent to relatives, and she was re-hospitalized. This time, she attempted suicide. Anne Sexton began writing poems in 1956 while recovering from a nervous breakdown. A Rorschach test a psychiatrist had given her showed untapped creative talent. He suggested she watch a Boston educational television station, and she did. One night, she watched How to Write a Sonnet. Sexton thought to herself, "I could do that, maybe. I could try." She began writing, and in an effort to encourage her, her psychiatrist said, "Don't kill yourself. Your poems might mean something to someone someday." When speaking about her poems, Sexton said, "I began to think that if one life, somehow made into art, were recorded, not all of it, but like the testimony of an old tombstone, wouldn't that be worth something? Just one life, a poor middle-class life, nothing extraordinary. Except maybe madness, but that's so common nowadays. That seems worth putting down. It's the thing I have to do, the thing I want to do. I'm not sure why." In 1957, Sexton enrolled in a poetry workshop at the Boston Center for Adult Education. Here she met Maxine Kuhman, who was to become her lifelong friend. She received encouragement from W.D. Snodgrass, who also wrote autobiographical poems. She was accepted into Robert Lowell's graduate course at Boston University, where her classmates included Sylvia Plath. In 1960, her first book, To Bedlam and Partway Back, was accepted for publication. She began teaching poetry classes at Harvard and Radcliffe. Her second book, All My Pretty Ones, was nominated for a National Book Award. She won a fellowship to travel to Europe and a Ford Foundation grant to work in the theater. But Sexton was still not a well woman, and she continued to attempt suicide, resulting in hospitalizations. She also had a growing dependency on drugs and alcohol. In 1967, Sexton was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her third book of poems, Live or Die. She said this book reads, quote, "like a fever chart for a bad case of melancholy," unquote. Most critics were kind, and even the negative reviews gave her credit for the personal appeal of her work. But a poem titled Menstruation at 40 tipped these critics over the edge. Still, she went on to form a rock group, Her Kind, and recited her poems while the band played. In a long red satin dress, cigarette dangling, audiences loved her. She continued to receive both awards and attacks. In 1969, Love Poems was published. 2 years later, Transformations, her adaptations of grim fairy tales. She taught at BU, and honorary degrees began piling up. By 1970, Sexton's life began spiraling out of control. She attempted another suicide that year, and in 1973, she was hospitalized 3 times. Also in 1973, she divorced her husband, and her dependence on friends became way too taxing. She was addicted to vodka, Thorazine, and sleeping pills. Sexton pushed herself to write, but her writing was losing its strength. By January 1974, she wrote to a friend, "All is rush or pain or glory. I think my life is becoming like the perils of Pauline. It is exaggerating itself. On October 4th, 1974, after having lunch with Maxine Kuman, Sexton went home to revise some new poems. At 3:30 in the afternoon, she poured herself a glass of vodka, put on her mother's old mink coat, and went into the garage. She sealed the door, turned on the car's engine, and put a brick on the gas pedal to make sure the carbon monoxide poison kept coming. She was found dead, the vodka bottle on the dash. Next, I'm going to play a recording of Anne Sexton reading a number of her poems.
The operation. After the sweet promise, the summer's mild retreat from mother's cancer, the winter months of her death, I come to this white office, its sterile sheet, its hard tablet, its stirrups, to hold my breath while I, who must, allow the glove its oily rape, to hear the almost mighty doctor over me equate my ills with hers and decide to operate. It grew in her as simply as a child would grow, as simply as she housed me once, fat and female. Always my most gentle house, before that embryo of evil spread in her shelter, and she grew frail. Frail, we say, remembering fear, that face we wear in the room of the special smells of dying, fear where the snoring mouth gapes and is not dear. There was snow everywhere. Each day I gruel through its sloppy peak, its blue-struck days, my boots slapping into the hospital halls, past the retinue of nurses at the desk, to murmur in cahoots with hers outside her door, to enter with the outside air stuck on my skin, to enter smelling her pride, her upkeep, and to lie as all who love have lied. No reason to be afraid, my almost mighty doctor reasons. I nod, thinking that woman's dying must come in seasons, thinking the bill must be paid, thinking that living is worth buying. I walk out, scuffing a raw leaf, kicking the clumps of dead straw that were this summer's lawn. Automatically I get in my car, knowing the historic thief is loose in my house and must be set upon. Clean of the body's hair, I lie smooth from breast to leg. All that was special, all that was rare, is common here. Fact, death too is in the egg. Fact, the body is dumb, the body is meat. And tomorrow the OR, only the summer was sweet. The rooms down the hall are calling all night long, while the night outside sucks at the trees. I hear limbs falling and see yellow eyes flick in the rain. Wide-eyed and still whole, I turn in my bin like a shorn lamb. A nurse's flashlight blinds me to see who I am. The walls color in a wash of daylight until the room takes its objects into itself again. I smoke furtively and squash the butt and hide it with my watch and other effects. The halls bustle with legs. I smile at the nurse who smiles for the morning shift. Day is worse. Schedule late, I cannot drink nor eat, except for yellow pills and a jigger of water. I wait and think until she brings two mysterious needles, the skill she knows, promising soon you'll be out. But nothing is sure, no one. I wait in doubt. I wait like a kennel of dogs jumping against their fence. At 10 she returns, laughs and catalogues my resistance to drugs. On the stretcher, citizen and boss of my own body still, I glide down the halls and rise in the iron cage toward science and pitfalls. The great green people stand over me. I roll on the table under a terrible sun, following their command to curl, head touching knee, if I am able. Next, I am hung up like a saddle, and they begin. Pale as an angel, I float out over my own skin. I soar in hostile air, over the pure women in labor, over the crowning heads of babies being born. I plunge down the back stair, calling mother at the dying door, to rush back to my own skin, tied where it was torn. Its nerves pull like wires, snapping from the leg to the rib. Strangers, their faces rolling like hoops, require my arm. I am lifted into my aluminum crib. Skull flat, hair in my harness, thick with shock, I call mother to help myself, call toe of frog, that woolly bat, that tongue of dog, call God help, and all the rest. The soul that swam the furious water sinks now and flies, and the brain flops like a docked fish, and the eyes are flat boat decks riding out the pain. My nurses, those starchy ghosts, hover over me for my lame hours and my lame days. The mechanics of the body pump for their tricks. I rest on their needles, am dosed and snoring amid the orange flowers and the eyes of visitors. I wear, like some senile woman, a scarlet candy package ribbon in my hair. 4 days from home, I lurk on my mechanical parapet with two pillows at my elbows, as soft as praying cushions. My knees work with the bed that runs on power. I grumble to forget the lie I ought to hear, but don't. God knows I thought I'd die, but here I am, recalling mother, the sound of her good morning, the odor of orange and jam. All's well, they say. They say I'm better. I lounge in frills or picturesque. I wear bunny pink slippers in the hall. I read a new book and shuffle past the desk to mail the author my first fan letter. Time now to pack this Humpty Dumpty back the frightened way she came, and run along, Anne, and run along now, my stomach laced up like a football for the game. The truth, the dead know. Gone, I say, and walk from church, refusing the stiff procession to the grave, letting the dead ride alone in the hearse. It is June. I am tired of being brave. We drive to the Cape. I cultivate myself where the sun gutters from the sky, where the sea swings in like an iron gate, and we touch. In another country, people die. My darling, the wind falls in like stones from the white-hearted water. And when we touch, we enter touch entirely. No one's alone. Men kill for this or for as much. And what of the dead? They lie without shoes in their stone boats. They are more like stone than the sea would be if it stopped. They refuse to be blessed, throat, eye, and knuckle bone. To a friend whose work has come to triumph. Consider Icarus, pasting those sticky wings on, testing that strange little tug at his shoulder blade. And think of that first flawless moment over the lawn of the labyrinth. Think of the difference it made. There below are the trees, as awkward as camels, and here are the shocked starlings pumping past. And think of innocent Icarus, who is doing quite well. Larger than a sail over the fog and the blast of the plushy ocean he goes. Admire his wings. Feel the fire at his neck and see how casually he glances up and is caught, wondrously tunneling into that hot eye. Who cares that he fell back to the sea? See him acclaiming the sun and come plunging down while his sensible daddy goes straight into town. Old Dwarf Heart. When I lie down to love, old Dwarf Heart shakes her head. Like an imbecile, she was born old. Her eyes wobble as 31 thick folds of skin open to glare at me on my flickering bed. She knows the decay we're made of. When hurt, she's abrupt. Now she is solid like fat, breathing in loops like a green hen in the dust. But if I dream of loving, then my dreams are of snarling strangers, She dreams that. Strange, strange, and corrupt. Good God, the things she knows. And worse, the sores she holds in her hands, gathered in like a nest from a ruined field. At her best, she is all red muscle, humming in and out, cajoled by time. Where I go, she goes. Oh, now I lay me down to love. How awkwardly her arms undo. How patiently I untangle her wrists like knots. Old ornament, old naked fist. Even if I put on 70 coats, I could not cover you. Mother, father, I'm made of.
You, Dr. Martin. You, Dr. Martin, walk from breakfast to madness. Late August, I speed through the antiseptic tunnel where the moving dead still talk of pushing their bones against the thrust of cure. And I am queen of this summer hotel or the laughing bee on a stalk of death. We stand in broken lines and wait while they unlock the door and count us at the frozen gates of dinner. The shibboleth is spoken, and we move to gravy in our smock of smiles. We chew in rows. Our plates scratch and whine like chalk in school. There are no knives for cutting your throat. I make moccasins all morning. At first, my hands kept empty, unraveled for the lives they used to work. Now I learn to take them back, each angry finger that demands I mend what another will break tomorrow. Of course I love you. You lean above the plastic sky, god of our block, prince of all the foxes. The breaking crowns are new, the jack wore. Your third eye moves among us and lights the separate boxes where we sleep or cry. What large children we are here. All over I grow most tall in the best ward. Your business is people. You call at the madhouse, an oracular eye in our nest. Out in the hall, the intercom pages you. You twist in the pull of the foxy children who fall like floods of life in frost. And we are magic talking to itself, noisy and alone. I am queen of all my sins forgotten. Am I still lost? Once I was beautiful, now I am myself, counting this row and that row of moccasins, waiting on the silent shelf.
Noon walk on the asylum lawn. The summer sun ray shifts through a suspicious tree, though I walk through the valley of the shadow. It sucks the air and looks around for me. The grass speaks. I hear green chanting all day. I will fear no evil, fear no evil. The blades extend and reach my way. The sky breaks. It sags and breathes upon my face. In the presence of mine enemies, the world is full of enemies. There is no safe place.
For my lover returning to his wife, she is all there. She was carefully melted down for you and cast up from your childhood, cast up from your 100 favorite Aggies. She has always been there, my darling. She is, in fact, exquisite. Fireworks in the dull middle of February and as real as a cast iron pot. Let's face it. I have been momentary, a luxury. A bright red sloop in the harbor, my hair rising like smoke from the car window. Little neck clams out of season. She is more than that. She is your have-to-have. Has grown you your practical, your tropical growth. This is not an experiment. She is all harmony. She sees to the oars and oarlocks for the dinghy, has placed wildflowers at the window at breakfast, sat by the potter's wheel at midday, set forth three children on the moon, three cherubs drawn by Michelangelo, done this with her legs spread out in the terrible months in the chapel. If you glance up, the children are there, like delicate balloons rising on the ceiling. She has also carried each one down the hall after supper, their heads privately bent, two legs protesting, person to person, her face flushed with a song in their little sleep. I give you back your heart. I give you permission. For the fuse inside her throbbing angrily in the dirt, for the bitch in her and the burying of her wound, for the burying of her small red wound alive, for the pale flickering flare under her ribs, for the drunken sailor who waits in her left pulse, for the mother's knee, for the stockings, for the garter belt, for the call, the curious call. When you will burrow in arms and breasts and tug at the orange ribbon in her hair and answer the call, the curious call. She is so naked and singular. She is the sum of yourself and your dream. Climb her like a monument, step after step. She is solid. As for me, I am a watercolor. I wash off.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You've been listening to the late poet Anne Sexton reading a number of her poems. I mentioned earlier in the program that her poem Menstruation at 40 is the poem that sent a number of critics right over the edge. They just couldn't handle it. It was too much. I do not have a recording of Anne Sexton reading that poem, so I am going to read it myself right now. Menstruation at 40. I was thinking of a sun. The womb is not a clock, nor a bell tolling, but in the 11th month of its life, I feel the November of the body as well as of the calendar. In 2 days it will be my birthday, and as always the earth is done with its harvest. This time I hunt for death, the night I lean toward, the night I want. Well then, speak of it. It was in the womb all along. I was thinking of a son, you, the never acquired, the never seated or unfastened, you of the genitals I feared, the stock in the puppy's breath. Will I give you my eyes or his? Will you be the David or the Susan? Those two names I picked and listened for. Can you be the man your fathers are, the leg muscles from Michelangelo, hands from Yugoslavia, somewhere the peasant, Slavic and determined, somewhere the survivor bulging with life? And could it still be possible, all this with Susan's eyes? All this without you, 2 days gone in blood. I myself will die without baptism, a third daughter they didn't bother. My death will come on my name day. What's wrong with a name day? It's only an angel of the sun. Woman, weaving a web over your own, a thin and tangled poison. Scorpio, bad spider, die. My death from the wrists, two name tags, blood worn like a corsage, to bloom, one on the left and one on the right. It's a warm room, the place of the blood. Leave the door open on its hinges. 2 days for your death, and 2 days until mine. Love, that red disease, year after year. David, you would make me wild. David, Susan, David, David, full and disheveled, hissing into the night, never growing old, waiting always for you on the porch, year after year. My carrot, my cabbage, I would have possessed you before all women, calling your name, calling you mine. And with that, we conclude the Anne Sexton portion of tonight's program. And as much as I do love Anne Sexton, I don't know about you, but I could use a little upper right now. So here's Carl Zero singing I Love You for Sentimental Reasons.
Sentimental reasons. I hope you do believe me. I'll give you my heart. I love you. And you were long, long meant for me. Please give your loving heart to me. And say we'll never part. Think of you every morning, dream of you every night, darling, I'm never lonely, whenever you're in sight, I love you, for sentimental reasons.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My thanks again to Brian So Jones, author of Raking the Hollow Bones, for joining me tonight. And please mark your calendars for Friday, October 16th at 7 p.m., when poets Rebecca Faust and Donna Emerson will read at the Sonoma County Museum, along with Daughters of Yam, that's with Devorah Major and Opal Palmer. Rebecca Faust will be reading from her book Dark Card, an award-winning book about raising her son with Asperger's syndrome. Donna Emerson will be reading from her newly published chapbook, and Daughters of Yam perform poems along with music. That's at the Word Temple Poetry Series, Sonoma County Museum, 425 7th Street in Santa Rosa. That's right near the mall. For more information, you can go to wordtemple.com, and while you're sitting there at your computer, check out the website for the Sonoma County Museum also. That is at sonomacountymuseum.org. You'll find directions to the museum and all kinds of information. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, I would love to hear them. You can reach me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.